7:30 on this West Virginia morning, I'm Beth Voorhees. Appalachian Studies professor Emily Satterwhite notices that horror movies play to the Appalachian stereotype.
I was intrigued by how many have a rural setting and how and why this same story told over and over again continued to have the capacity to be pitched as horror, or what there could be about the rural that would be so fearful.
The story coming up on this West Virginia morning. On Tuesday, voters will likely be choosing the state's first female U.S. senator. We spoke earlier this week with the Democratic contender, Secretary of State Natalie Tennant. Today, we hear from the Republican candidate, Congresswoman Shelley Moore Capito, who spoke to West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Scott Finn.
Congresswoman Capito, thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me on. Thank you for the opportunity.
There's been a lot of talk about the transition that's going on economically, especially in the southern coal fields. What do you think are the main drivers of the decline in coal field jobs?
Well, I think there's a couple drivers in the decline in the coal field, and a large part of it is the regulatory environment. Certainly with the EPA, we see it directly attributable to losing jobs. I think also the rise in the amount of natural gas that's available. And then probably market conditions. Exporting, I think, is down. And I think that's part of the reason. I think it's all of the above, but I do think some things you can't change, but you certainly can change the regulatory environment.
So with that in mind, do you think this is a permanent or a temporary downturn in the coal economy?
Well, I'm certainly hoping it's a temporary downturn. I think that coal is the baseline fuel for power generation in this country and has been for years. I think that certainly, it probably will not rebound to the point where it has been at its peak, and I think we all realize that. But I think that we will see a regeneration in the coal fields because it's a make-sense energy producer for this country, and it's right here in the country, in the state.
So on one hand, we're hearing a lot of talk about, especially in this campaign, about protecting coal jobs and increasing the coal jobs. But on the other hand, don't we need to be talking about transitioning these coal fields to a different type of economy that's less dependent on coal?
Well, I think that, you know, the reality is that transitioning and looking at other opportunities is in our best interest. I was just visiting with a business in Huntington, and it's a high-tech kind of manufacturing that will create jobs for tomorrow and the next generation. And I think that obviously high tech is something that would help us transition in the coal fields. But I still believe that, you know, we need to, you know, we don't want to hoist the flag on our coal industry at all, because I think that is still a very vital part of our economic fabric in the state of West Virginia. But certainly there's lots of possibilities with insourcing jobs, whether it's biometrics or forensics. We see that down in at Marshall University. These are things I think we do need to look at for the next generation of jobs in southern West Virginia, absolutely.
There's been a decline in mineable reserves. That's been a long-standing decline. There's been a decline in jobs. If you look at the long-term trend, it's been just down, down, down. Do you really believe that a change in regulatory climate is going to have a long-term effect on that trend?
I do think a change in the regulatory climate will have a long-term effect, because you've got to look at, in my opinion, you've got to look at a base load of energy generation. And in a state like West Virginia, so heavily reliant on coal for our power generation, that's not just turning the lights on. That's also manufacturing jobs. And so I think in order to keep that base load of energy production while we develop renewables and other resources is critical to the infrastructure of the country.
And we're talking with Congresswoman Shelley Moore Capito, the Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate. Medicaid expansion in West Virginia means that there are more than 100,000 people here that now have health insurance that didn't before. Would you vote to end that Medicaid expansion?
Well, I did not vote for Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. I don't think, as it's being rolled out, the act in and of itself is working for small businesses or individuals. There are good parts of it, and I've said this from the beginning. And I think the more people we have insured, the better. So what I would like to do is transition to a system that that works for the 140,000 folks who are on Medicaid too, but also works for small businesses and people who are presently employed who see their premiums and their deductibles skyrocketing and limiting their choice. I think there's a way through tax credits and other things to make sure that this expansion of Medicaid is part of the working family's life, and it encourages folks to keep working and try to work their way out of a Medicaid system into a privately sponsored health insurance plan.
Could you name a couple of things that you would make sure to keep and a couple of things specifically that you'd want to change or jettison entirely about the Affordable Care Act?
Okay, well, the things I think that need to be kept are that we shouldn't be throwing people off of their insurance for a pre-existing condition. Health reform was looked at in a bipartisan way to begin with, and it didn't end that way in the end. But part of the reason that was looked at is because the system was broken and then was costing folks who had family members with pre-existing conditions to be able to not be able to be insured. That is a good thing that we've done that. Leaving your children on your insurance until you're age 26, that's another good thing. Somebody approached me yesterday and said that that's worked well for their family. I think some of the help that seniors are getting in terms of closing the gap on their Medicare prescription drug plan is a good thing. So there's some good things that are in the Affordable Care Act. The things that I would jettison, number one, a lot of the business mandate is causing a lot of businesses to radically change their health insurance plans. I've talked to people who premiums have gone up anywhere from 37 to 67, some not as much, but it's really causing a burden on individuals who are working and the small business. The business mandate also is a disincentive to hire over to have more than 50 employees. If you're at 47, 48, some people want to expand. They're not going to because of the business mandate. The business mandate is also forcing some businesses to look at their definition of part-time and full-time. So a lot of people are getting moved from 40-hour work week to a 30-hour work week. That is particularly damaging in larger percent to women in the workforce for some of the statistics that I've seen. So those are some of the things that I would radically change.
Now, there are some people that say that if you jettison things such as the individual mandate to buy health insurance or the business requirements to provide health insurance, that you can do that, but then you can't have some of these other things, such as a working insurance system that requires insurance companies to keep people on regardless of pre-existing conditions. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that wasn't addressed in the Affordable Care Act was the really cost containment issues. And I think if we work on those issues, either through selling insurance across state lines, medical liability reform, small business association health plans, so we can try to contain costs, I think that that would probably help us be able to afford things like keeping people on if they have a pre-existing condition. You know, if you look at the way that the mix of people in the state of West Virginia, we only have one available and possibly another one coming on this year, but last year just one available plan, you know, that's not choice, and that there's no way that that can bring any kind of cost containment. So I think in West Virginia we've been particularly disadvantaged in terms of our choice aspect that we were promised under the Affordable Care Act.
Congresswoman, thank you so much for joining us.
All right, thanks, Scott.
That's Congresswoman Shelley Moore Capito, the Republican candidate for U.S. Senate, speaking with Scott Finn. The race for the seat in the state's first congressional district pits Republican Congressman David McKinley against Democratic State Auditor Glenn Gaynor, and is a contest that political pundits say swings heavily in favor of the incumbent. Today we hear from McKinley as he shares his thoughts with Ashton Mara on the proposed carbon emission rules set forth by the Environmental Protection Agency, an agency he's been quick to speak out against.
Is your opposition to that agency one that's focused on jobs or other issues?
That's an interesting way to portray it. Probably two ways. One, it is over jobs. We got to be more gradual the way I approach things. If anyone comes from the private sector, as I do, is you got to gradually make change. You can't do it overnight. And that's what the EPA is doing now, putting imposing regulations on us that we can't achieve overnight. Some of the is what's happened with the carbon capture program that they're doing. The technology is not there and won't be there for 10 or 15 years. Why don't we phase it in instead of doing something overnight, passing it? As a result, no one's going to build a new coal-fired powerhouse. If you don't build a new coal-fired powerhouse, you have less likely that you're going to open a new coal mine in West Virginia to produce that. So it has an impact with that. So we're saying, just go gradually with this. The other is I'm questioning their science. It's a mixed bag. There are some people who say the science is settled, but yet the other, you're going to find out there are 30-some thousand scientists that signed a petition said it's not settled. We want to understand how climate change is occurring. I know it is. You and I both know it is. 150 years ago, the temperature of the globe was 1.4 degrees cooler than it is today. The oceans were 8 inches shallower than they were today. So something's happening. I'm not sure that we can just use a simplistic route and say it's all because of coal and natural gas, because that's not accurate. If we stop burning all coal in America totally, every coal-fired generating plant, every manufacturer, every hospital, any institution, anyone that burns coal to create steam or electricity, it would only reduce, this comes from the United Nations, the IPCC report, it would only reduce the CO2 emissions of the world by 0.2%. Now, is it worth risking our economy in America for 0.2% when no one else is following us? China and India both are planning to burn more coal and a lot more coal than we are in America. Germany has switched from gas and nuclear to coal. So the rest of the world is going to be burning more coal. And the only one that will have risked their economy by shifting to some other product is the United States. And I'm nervous about it for our economy, because our coal miners and gas workers, they're hardworking people. And why are we going to put them out? And what are the results going to be? Higher utility bills. Is that really worth it? I'm not sure, because we're not sure of the connection between gas and the CO2 levels.
There are obviously people out there who would disagree with your position.
Of course they would.
But there are people out there who say, you know, it's just getting more and more expensive to mine the coal that's there. Those seams are harder to reach. So West Virginia saw the same decline in the past in the steel industry, which was big in your district as well. So do you think those industries, despite the regulations, could still make a comeback?
Oh, absolutely. But we're not talking about, see, you're taking that simplistic approach. We're just talking about West Virginia. Coal was mined in 27 states in America, and they're not always the same type of seams that we have here. Go out and look at the Powder Ridge Basin out in the West, where they're talking about 60-foot seams of coal that we can't imagine having that kind of seam of coal here in America. So their economy in Wyoming is even more dependent on coal than it is in West Virginia, if you can imagine that. And there's a threat to stop the use of coal. You're going to shut down Wyoming. You're going to shut down West Virginia. You're going to affect Indiana, Illinois, and Kentucky, a lot of those. Just be careful how we approach it. My approach as an engineer, and I'm just one of two licensed engineers in Washington, is let's use the technology that we have. We have some of the best and brightest universities and physicists and scientists in this country. Why aren't we continuing to invest in research so that we can burn our coal and burn our natural gas in a clean way?
That is Republican Congressman David McKinley. He'll be Ashton Mara's guest on Viewpoint this morning. The show airs right here on West Virginia Public Radio at 9 a.m. Also today, we profile the final third-party candidate running for U.S. Senate, Phil Hudock. The Constitution Party chairman, Hudock, has run for office before at the state level, but now says he wants to make a change in the way the public thinks about its government.
I'm going after it to win it.
When you ask Phil Hudock if he thinks he can actually win the Senate race against some major names, or if he's just running to shake up the conversation, Hudock says he's serious about this race and about changing the way the general public views their government.
I think we need a different psyche within the people. They have to have the mindset that it's our government. When I was petitioning to get ballot access, there were people who told me, "You're going to get arrested." I was threatened arrest by the manager of a regional DMV for collecting petitions on a sidewalk. And I had to call the governor's office and have him corrected that I did indeed have the constitutional right to do that. So people think there's the government and then there's the people, and it's our government. It's not two entities. It's ours, and we need to take control of it, take responsibility for it.
Hudak is a retired science teacher and father of four daughters. He says the bleak future for his girls is just one more reason why he decided to run.
But what I see is no future for them. I see a moral meltdown. I see a disregard for the Constitution and the rule of law. So when I decided to search for the truth and realized that the truth will, only the truth will set you free, I had to follow my convictions and stand up for what's right.
What's right, Hudak says, is doing what's best for the people, something he doesn't always see happening now in politics.
There are people who want to engineer the world as they would like it. And so they are active. They're not passive. They're active. They're making things happen the way they want it to happen for their good. And it's not necessarily the good of the general public.
Hudak differs from his opponents in many ways, one of which is on climate change, which he cites as an example of one way he thinks politicians are trying to take advantage of the public.
I think if you disregard the hype and you look at the facts and, again, go against political correctness, my scientific background tells me that global warming is a fraud, okay, that it's a power play to control and make money, to control the public. In my 40 years of teaching, we've gone from global cooling to global warming to global change. And when we can control the sun, we can control the climate.
But like some of his opponents, including the Libertarian candidate, Hudak believes the government should stay out of regulating most industries, including the growing natural gas industry in northern and north central West Virginia.
All they need to do is keep a level playing field. As a matter of fact, when you have the government giving tax breaks to a certain few, the government is actually violating a level playing field.
Hudak admits he takes an extreme stance on some issues, but will that catch the attention of the voters? He's hoping it does. You can find out more about all the candidates for U.S. Senate on our website, wvpublic.org. This is West Virginia Morning. It's 7:47. Rain likely today. Temperatures will be in the 40s and 50s. Rain overnight with lows in the 30s. A winter weather advisory is in effect from 8 o'clock tonight to 2 o'clock Saturday afternoon for McDowell and Wyoming counties. Rain and snow in the forecast on Saturday. Daytime highs in the 30s and 40s. Partly sunny on Sunday with highs in the 40s.
There is a vehicle accident on eastbound I-64 at mile marker 4.5 near Huntington. Please use caution if you're traveling in this area.
There's a growing need to get more women interested in computers and technology. That's one reason why West Virginia University's Reed College of Media hosted a hackathon last weekend. But as Emily Corio reports, it wasn't a traditional hackathon. Corio was a facilitator at the event that focused on women, media, and wearable technology, and brings us this report.
When I signed on to participate in the Women's Hackathon on Wearables, I didn't know entirely what I was getting into. I was familiar with the term hackathon, but I never thought of it as something I would be part of. I'm not a computer programmer, and that's what these events typically involve. But I liked the idea of collaborating and creating something. Over 40 students felt the same way. Most were from WVU, but some were from Carnegie Mellon, Penn State, Howard University, Syracuse, and Georgetown. Faculty and staff from these universities also took part. Here's what a few of them had to say going into the event Friday night.
I think it'll be a learning experience. I think it'll also help me decide if I want to major in something with technology.
I know that traditionally there actually is a gender gap between male and female in media and technology fields, so I really want to improve my skills in this event.
I've read all the collateral that's sent out prior and, you know, hoped that that would give me an idea. But I think that part of what this weekend entails is not having those boundaries.
Those were the thoughts of students Hillary Godden and Maggie Kong and Catherine Dye of the Health Sciences and Technology Academy at WVU. That first evening, the women at WVU were connected through the web with a panel discussion at Google in California. They heard from women leaders in technology. On Saturday and Sunday, more women gave informative and inspirational talks to the group.
How are we going to control the minds of our audience?
But participants spent most of their time in small groups, working with each other on a challenge to develop a technology. It could be a device or an app that relates to wearables. Wearables are mini computers that can be found in watches, glasses, or bracelets. They perform tasks like taking video or monitoring fitness. WVU Reed College of Media Dean Marianne Reed says the event was a great exercise in quick problem solving and exposed young women to ideas they might otherwise not indulge.
I do think it creates access or opens up the doors to people who are intimidated by technology, and really showing them that what is behind technology are ideas and people.
Reed College of Media professor Dana Kester wanted to put together the event for women because she says they're often overlooked in technology development.
It's about shifting people from being consumers, sort of a set thing, to being makers. And hacking, you know, there's pejorative connotations of the word, but it's also about making it your own, making it do what you want it to do.
The event was co-produced by PBS Media Shift, an online publication that looks at changes in the media industry. Events coordinator Beth Lang says this hackathon was more focused than others they've hosted. She saw its all-female environment as a benefit.
The atmosphere is so much more comfortable. They don't feel like they're going to put themselves in a bad position by asking a question, be thought less of.
At the end of the hackathon, student Katie Heller was leaving with an idea she helped hatch and with confidence to generate more ideas like it.
I think that when women get in an uninhibited environment, then we do amazing things. And this really showcases our ability.
The hackathon ended Sunday afternoon with 8 teams pitching their ideas.
Team Ghost.
The celebrated team came up with an accessory to the popular Fitbit, a wireless wearable device that tracks activity. They call their innovation the BioBit. It would connect to the Fitbit bracelet and could measure certain nutrient levels and notify the wearer if they're deficient. Judges told the creators to try to patent their idea immediately. There was no monetary award, but Media Shift will publish an article on BioBit. The takeaway for all was about process, the process of innovation. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Emily Corio in Morgantown.
Halloween reminds us that it can sometimes be fun to explore the dark side, and the rise in popularity of horror movies of the last couple of decades seems to confirm that. A Virginia Tech professor of pop culture is taking a closer look at scary movies to see what they tell us about the stereotypes that drive them. Robbie Harris has more.
Associate Professor of Appalachian Studies Emily Satterwhite is not a huge fan of horror movies, but she's forcing herself to keep her eyes open, even during the gory parts, to take a closer look at what's behind their growing popularity and what they say about rural Appalachia.
I was intrigued by how many have a rural setting and how and why this same story told over and over again continued to have the capacity to be pitched as horror, or what there could be about the rural that would be so fearful.
Satterwhite lays out the kind of familiar plot line which has become a trope, a cue for viewers that it's time to be afraid.
You have your outsiders coming to go camping or traveling through the rural backwoods. There might be a cabin, and they'll be set upon by locals, and they won't make it out alive in the most recent versions.
Yo, Chuck, speed up, man.
Yeah, man.
then speed up.
Yeah, guys, this is my dad's car. So if I go any faster, he will kill me.
Oh, we are on hillbilly country now, boys.
The 2010 spoof, Tucker and Dale versus Evil, starts out like so many horror movies with that fateful camping trip, but soon turns the horror movie genre upside down, giving us a different perspective on the usual themes.
Just because it does such a beautiful job of lampooning all of the stereotypes about what there is to be feared in the woods. And of course, in that movie, it turns out that it's the prejudices of the young people, the outsiders, that are the thing that they should fear the most, because that's what gets them into trouble, is their assumptions that the men wearing overalls are the bad guys.
Satterwhite wrote a book called Dear Appalachia, Readers, Identity, and Popular Fiction since 1878. And when it comes to horror movies, she says, there are real effects from the way rural Appalachia is portrayed. For example, she's heard from people promoting the travel industry in West Virginia that some people are afraid to visit because horror movies have scared them away.
It's very obvious to me how harmful the stereotypes are and how negative they are. But what I'm really interested in is if one of the reasons for the fascination, for the continuous coming back to the idea of a rural world cut off from the rest of the nation and the world, is a kind of wishfulness about that. A fear of it, sure. What would happen if I went in any kind of fish out of water scenario. But also for that particular fish out of water scenario to be popular again and again, I wonder if people really want to believe that there can be a place that is somehow escaped consumer capitalist society, for better and for worse. But it's the better part that I'm really curious about, and that's one reason that I'm combing through hundreds and thousands of online customer reviews, trying to see if there's any evidence to back me up on this hunch.
Satterwhite will teach a humanities seminar next semester at Virginia Tech on the function of horror movies. I'm Robbie Harris.
Are you sure we should be doing this? This is still a crime scene.
Sack up, Billy. It's called investigative journalism for a reason.
Yeah, but don't we need like a press pass or a permit or something?
Press pass this! You know, the police missed something here. I can feel it. What do you say, Billy? Won't a Peabody Award look great up on your...
Judith Owens' latest album, Ebb and Flow, pays tribute to the artists who inspired her, like Carole King, along with James Taylor and the Beatles. Here she is with Blackbird on this Mountain Stage Song of the Week.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly.
This moment to be free.
with Blackbird. You can hear this song again and more music Saturday night at 8 on Mountain Stage, right here on West Virginia Public Radio. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Keep up with all the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. West Virginia Morning is produced with the assistance of Suzanne Higgins, Clark Davis, Jessica Lilly, Glynis Board, Dave Mistich, Roxy Todd, and Liz McCormick. Our theme music is by Matt Jackford. Our producer is Ashton Mara. Our director is Teresa Wills. I'm Beth Voorhees.
Support for NPR comes from Zillow. With homes for sale, historical pricing data, and photos available on Zillow.com or on their mobile apps, Zillow, find your way home. RingCentral, offering cloud business phone systems for today's mobile and distributed workforces. Learn more at RingCentral.com. And Ford. Ford is proud to support NPR and the Changing Lives of Women series. Stories of women driving change are at NPR.org. This is West Virginia Public Radio, WVPB Charleston, WVBY Beckley, WVBL Bluefield, WVPW Buchanan, WVWV Huntington, WVEP Martinsburg, WVPM Morgantown, WVPG Parkersburg, WVDS Petersburg, WVWS Webster Springs, WVNP Wheeling, and we're online at wvpublic.org.